Hi, everybody. My name is Rob Mason. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of recovery I found in this book, excellent sponsorship, lots of service, and sponsoring lots and lots of people, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since the 7th of July, 1988. For that, I am extremely grateful. And they told me not to touch the mic, so the first thing I'm going to do is touch the mic. One housekeeping note here. Somebody asked me last week, and I got to write stuff down or I forget it, about the these workshops. And they said, you know, how did you get to do this workshop at Central? And it was really difficult. I got asked to do it. That's how it happened. So if you are interested, I only do these when I get asked to do them. And I've just gotten asked to do them for a long time. And so if you're interested in doing one of these, if you have a group that would like to host one of these, please come up and see me. I have a very, you know, open schedule for the most part, and I'll go anywhere to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So with that, let's open our book to page 8. We left off in the middle of Bill's story last week. And last week, you'll remember, we spent pretty much the entire session talking about step 1. Hold on, I need to find something here to prop this up a little bit. My book's falling apart. I keep threatening to get it rebound, and I haven't done it yet. But we spent the entire session talking about step 1. We talked about the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth's theory about alcoholism, the idea that we have an allergy of the body, which manifests itself with a craving, a physiological craving for alcohol, that he called a phenomenon, which means it can't be explained. And we still can't explain it today. I mean, we know why it happens, but we still don't know why it is that this craving occurs. And coupled with this physiological allergy, we have this mental obsession, this idea that we're going to talk about a little bit more tonight, that somehow, every once in a while, I have a mind that convinces me, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that it's okay to drink. And I begin drinking believing that I can do so, the physical allergy kicks in, and then away I go. Then I'm not drinking because I want to, I'm drinking because I have to. Okay? Tonight, Bill is going to segue into the second step. He's going to segue about, Bill's story is actually a segue chapter. It switches from the problem that we've been talking about in the doctor's opinion in the first half of Bill's story into what we're going to be talking about today, which is, what is the solution? Now that we've identified the problem, what is the solution to our problem? And we're going to start right at the bottom of page 8, those last two lines, where Bill begins to describe, and remember, Bill has already been to Towns Hospital, he's already admitted defeat, he's already taken the first step, okay, and yet he's drunk again. And he finds himself in November of 1934 in the kitchen, in his house, and he's about to be visited by what he calls an old school friend. So let's see what it says here. Bottom of page 8. Says, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. And then in that funny italicized writing, it says he was sober, right? Now, the reason that is significant is because Bill always said to himself, if I ever get as bad as Ebby Thatcher, I'm going to quit drinking, right? But here's Ebby coming to visit him, and Bill's drunk, and Ebby is sober, okay? It says, it was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him, unmindful of his welfare. I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days, right? And boy, I'll tell you, when I first read this, boy, that really jumped out to me, you know, because that was always what it was about. It was always about the old days. Anybody here like that, right? It wasn't about what drinking was going to be like today. It was always about what it was like 10 years ago, right? And how I could feel the way I felt when I had that first drink, right? And trying to recapture that feeling that I had, right? And again and again and again, and being unable to do it. It goes on to say, there was a time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, of the very thing an oasis. Drinkers are like that. And listen to the words Bill uses to describe his meeting, his encounter with Ebby. He says, the door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? Now, has Ebby said anything yet? He hasn't said anything yet, has he? Right? But Bill says he can already tell, before he's even said anything, that there is something very different about this man that I have known most of my life. Okay? Bill knew this guy since high school. Okay? They went to high school together. Okay? Now, it says, what had happened? Who could tell me what had happened? Ebby had a spiritual experience. Okay? Bill is looking at a spiritual experience. Okay? And he's going to go on to describe it. He goes on to say, I pushed a drink across the table and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got it into the fellow. He wasn't himself, Bill says. Come, what's this about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion. Right? Bill says, I was aghast. I love that word. Right? I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. But he had that starry-eyed look. Everybody underline that. We're going to come back to that. It goes on to say, listen to this, listen to how he describes it. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching, right? Bill's even ready to let the guy preach at him as long as he can drink, right? I can relate to that, right? As long as I can drink, you can say whatever you want to say, right? You see, Bill's not only looking at a spiritual experience, okay? Bill's looking at what we would call today a pink cloud experience, isn't he, right? He says the old boy was on fire, doesn't he, right? And we see people like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we, right? There's nothing they won't do in AA, right? You see them, though, they'll be running around the fellowship. Here, I'll get those ashtrays. Let me go pick up that newcomer. I'll go to the detox meeting. I'll do this. Oh, let me set up those chairs, right? You see them 6 months later, they're like, oh, hell, let the newcomer do it, right? That's how I was, right? We get well pretty quick around here, don't we, right? And unfortunately, I hear a lot of talk about pink clouds. People like to talk about pink clouds in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And unfortunately, people like to put them down. And I don't believe we should put them down. I believe we should build them up. Because I believe that the pink cloud is the first outward manifestation of the spirit within a person beginning to come awake. Right? And I'll tell you, it never fails me. There's a very few things in this world that really upset me. Okay? But one of the things that upsets me is when I'll go to a meeting and you'll see somebody with 90 days of sobriety, and they'll raise their hand at a meeting, and they'll talk about how grateful they are, and how their life's coming back together, and how their family's coming back, and how they're making their amends, and they've got a job, and they're excited about being in AA, and it never fails that there's always somebody in the back of the room who's just got to step all over their spiritual experience, don't they? Right? And they'll say something like, yeah, well, wait till you've been sober 8 years like me. You'll be just as miserable as I am, right? And let me tell you something. If you're new here, okay? If you're new here, if you're less than a year here, you don't, and I've heard people say this, well, if I see somebody who's too happy in AA, I stay away from. Anybody ever heard that? Right? Yeah. Okay, well, let me be the first one to tell you, you don't have to be miserable around here, okay? As a matter of fact, if you look over on page 8, in the middle of that page there, it says, I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Right? On page 85, when we get into the ninth step promises, it's going to say we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness, right? On page 132, it's going to tell us that God wants us, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And on page 133, it says God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free, okay? Now, that's my experience, okay? That's been my experience. Have I had bad days in sobriety? Absolutely. My mom had cancer last year. That was a bad day, a real bad day, right? I've had friends of mine die in sobriety, people that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those were bad days, you know. But I'm like the guy in the third chapter, Fred. Fred's going to say that he wouldn't trade his worst moments today for the best times in his old life. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous because I practiced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But I'll tell you, there are some people in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that really believe, see, and the funny thing is, if you ask them the question, you got to ask the right question. What are you doing? Right? Ask that question, and you will find a common theme. That the people that are miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous are not doing Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? They're not working the steps. They're not sponsored. They're not sponsoring. They're not in service. But alcoholics, let me tell you something. My experience in the 20 short years that I've been here has been this. Is that we are the first ones to take half the remedy and proclaim to everyone that it doesn't work. Right? We will proclaim to everyone that it doesn't work. Right? But let me tell you something, if you're new, you don't have to be miserable around here. Okay? That's not what this program is about. And thank God, that wasn't what Ebby went to Bill with. Yeah, Bill, if you get sober, life's going to suck. You think Bill would have responded to that? I don't think so, right? What impressed Bill about Ebby was that Ebby was a living demonstration of the spiritual experience. This was somebody he'd known all his life, and all of a sudden, there he's sitting in his kitchen, and there's something different about Ebby. Something very different about his friend. And now he's going to go on to talk about how he got this spiritual experience. Let's see what it says. Bottom of page 9. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea, step 3, and a practical program of action, steps 4 through 9. That was 2 months ago. Everybody circle that. We're coming back to it. And the result was self-evident. It worked. Right? That's a good reason. You know why you don't need to defend the program of AA? Because it works. That's why. You see, you don't need to defend something that works, do you? Right? And that's why I never defend the program of AA to anybody. I say, well, it worked for me. It worked for a lot of people I know, but maybe it won't work for you. I don't know. You know? So, a practical program of action and a simple religious idea. That's what Ebby came to share with Bill, right? And really, the third step is a simple religious idea. Okay? Every religion in the world will tell you to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Their conception of a power of God, right? The only difference with our program is we say you could pick whatever God you want. We're going to talk about that when we get into the fourth chapter. And a practical program of action. Remember that the Oxford Group program that they were working at this time was 6 steps, not 12. Okay? And the 6 steps were, the first step of their program was surrender, what became our third step. Okay? And we'll talk more about that when we get into chapter 5. The remainder of their steps were inventory, step 4, confession, step 5, restitution, steps 8 and 9, dependence on God, which is step again, part of step 3. And then when you got all done with that, you go out and try to carry this message to other people, right? Carry this message of this spiritual experience. So the simple religious idea that Ebby carried was step 3. The practical program of action was steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. What we have today is 4 through 9 and the idea of the 12th step. And he says that was 2 months ago, right? Now, how many people here have heard that you should wait 2 years before you carry the message or sponsor anybody? Anybody here ever heard that? They used to say that when I first came around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am forever grateful that Ebby didn't wait 2 years to go visit Bill, right? Because none of us would be here. I'm grateful that Bill didn't wait 2 years to go out and find Dr. Bob, right? Bill was 6 months sober when he made that trip to Akron, wasn't he? Right? So this, to me, is a timetable for sponsorship. It also means that Ebby has worked the six-step program in the first 2 months. Right? Okay? I think that's what we call a timetable for working the steps. I could be wrong. All right. Let's jump over to page 12. Top of the page, despite the living example of my friend, and again, this is what we're supposed to be to new people, a living example. We're going to talk about that when we get into chapter 2. I am supposed to be a living example of what? Of the common solution. The common solution. There remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea I could go for such conceptions as, and if you have a problem with this idea of God, here are some things you can use, creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature, but I resisted a thought of the czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. I could just see the scene, you know. I could see Ebby and they're going back and forth and they're talking about God. And, you know, Bill saying, you know, I can't go for this whole God thing, you know. And I'm sure Ebby didn't even realize it, but he said, look, he just probably got tired of arguing with me. He said, look, Bill, just pick your own God then. Just pick your own God. And what Ebby probably didn't realize is he just opened the door for thousands and possibly millions of people just like me, right? Just like me, right? Because that's where our program went from a religious program, which the Oxford Groups was, to a spiritual program, which Alcoholics Anonymous is, right? It says, why don't you choose your own conception of God, right? Now, I don't know about anybody else here, but But I've never had a problem with my own conception of anything, right? I had a problem with your conception of things, right? But I've never had a problem with my own conception, right? And I could work with that, right? And when we get into chapter 4, it's going to talk about that. That my own conception, however inadequate, boy, that let me off the hook. My conception doesn't have to even be adequate. I can have an inadequate conception of a power greater than myself, and I assure you that I did, and probably still do, okay? But no matter how inadequate, it will work for me, right? As long as I take other simple steps. It says, that statement hit me hard. It melted an icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning, right? It says, I saw that growth could start from that point upon a foundation of complete willingness. Everybody underline that. Upon a foundation of complete willingness. We're going to come back to that. I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus I was convinced. What did Bill just do? He just took the second step, didn't he? Right? Thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want Him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed, scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, and a new world came into view. Sounds to me like Bill's beginning to have this spiritual awakening that we're talking about, isn't it? Right? It goes on to say, the real significance of my experience at the cathedral, and this is referring back to what we talked about last week, Bill's experience at Winchester Cathedral in England, where he goes outside and sees the old tombstone of Thomas Thatcher and reads the epitaph on the tombstone. And he says that he had this sense of God's presence, but it's going to say it was blotted out, okay, that sense of His presence. It goes on to say, there had been for a brief moment I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have Him with me, and He came. But soon the sense of His presence had been blotted out. Everybody circle that. It's very important. Blotted out by what he calls worldly clamors, most of these within myself, and so it had been ever since. How blind I had been. You know, when we get into the fourth chapter, Bill's going to talk about on page 55, he's going to say that there are things that will block us off from God or obscure God from us. He's going to talk about pomp. He's going to talk about worship of other things. He's going to talk about self-will, right? Things that block us off from this sunlight of the Spirit. Here he's talking about it being blotted out by what he calls worldly clamors within himself, right? The entire purpose of steps 4 through 9, the action steps that we just talked about a minute ago, is to remove those things that block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. That's the whole purpose, so that I can have that spiritual experience by the time I get to step 12. And one of the things that happens when I remove that is that the obsession to drink is removed, and we're going to talk about that. And now we're going to see what Bill did to get this spiritual experience. Top of page 13, first paragraph. And everybody write right there in that little first paragraph down in that little empty spot, December 11th, 1934. That was the day Bill checked into the hospital, Towns Hospital, for the last time. Okay? December the 11th, 1934. And it says, there I hum... And let's see if we can see where Bill takes steps 3 through 11 while he's still in the hospital. Okay? It says, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood Him. To do with me as He would, I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. What step is that? Step 3, right? Okay? I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without Him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend, capital F, take them away, root and branch. That sounds like 6 and 7, doesn't it? I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate, that's Ebby, visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. What step's that? Step 5, right? We made a list of people that I had hurt or towards whom I felt resentment. Step 4. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Step 8. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Step 9. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Step 10. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as He would have me. Step 11. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive but that it would be in great measure. He goes on to say, my friend promised when these things were done. Not half done, right? When they were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. So if you want a new relationship with your Creator, if that's your goal, then you need to done these things, right? Not half done them, okay? And I'm a master at half done, right? I'm the guy that goes to the doctor because I'm sick. I take half the medicine, I start feeling better, and I stop taking it. Anybody else here like that? Right? Yeah, that's how I am, right? Because here's the thing. I mistake for a long time, and we're going to talk about this as we go through this workshop. I mistaked relief for freedom, right? Relief for freedom, right? See, what I need is freedom. But I'm the guy that I get a little bit of relief, and I say, that's enough. And I stop doing it. And that got me drunk over and over and over again, right? It says, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, with an S. Not just my alcohol problem, right? All of my problems. You see, the purpose of the 12 steps is not only to free me from the obsession to drink alcohol, but the purpose of the 12 steps is to give me a new manner of living, the book says. A new design for living. A new way of living. And somehow we've gotten this idea over the course of time that the only thing that Alcoholics Anonymous is for not drinking, right? For not drinking. And that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Alcoholics Anonymous is about a way of living which answers all of my problems, the book says. And that has been my experience in the very short time that I've been here, right? So, we just saw Bill take step 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, right? Let's go over to the next page, page 14. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Everybody circle that. Requirements. Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like requirements. We're going to talk about that in the second hour here. But did anybody know that we have requirements around here? Yeah. My sponsor said it's only a suggested program till you want to get sober. Then there are requirements, right? There are things that I must do if I want to stay sober. There's even a demand, which we're going to talk about when we get into the fifth chapter. Okay? I didn't know that, right? It goes on to say, simple but not easy. A price had to be paid, and here's the price. It meant this destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things, not some things, to the Father of light who presides over us all. So, little footnote here. This is a timetable for the 12 steps, isn't it? Right? Dr. Bob, we know, took the ninth step, what we now call the ninth step of the program of recovery, his first day of sobriety, June 10th, 1935. Bill Wilson, you could write right there at the top of page 14, December 14th, 1935. This experience, which he's going to describe in the next sentence, the next paragraph, happened on December 14th of 1935, 3 days after he checked into the hospital. Okay, so between December 11th and December 14th, Bill worked step 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Okay? Now, I don't know what you would call that, but I would call that a timetable for the steps. So, if you have heard or someone has told you a step a year is fine, take your time, don't hurry, et cetera, then what they're saying is, I know better than the founder of the program. That's what they're saying. Okay? Just wanted to point that out. All right. Next paragraph. Now we get the result. The result of what happened as a result of this course of action. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of the mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, spiritual awakening. But his impact on me was sudden and profound, spiritual experience. It goes on to say, jump down two paragraphs. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came to me that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly, it was imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Right? Now, how did Ebby work with Bill? He took him through the steps, didn't he? right? That's how Ebby worked with Bill, right? And somehow we've gotten this idea over the course of time that all sponsorship is taking somebody to a meeting, introducing them to a few people, giving them our sage wisdom, and that's sponsorship. But that's not what Bill's talking about here. He says, I need to work with others as Ebby worked with me. Ebby took Bill through the steps, the obsession was removed, and Bill had a spiritual experience. And unfortunately, there are not enough of us in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous doing that, right? There are not enough of us who are working the program of recovery out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result of that, some people are confused about what is and what is not the program of AA, right? And that's one of the reasons we do this workshop, okay? So we can get clear on what is and what is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It goes on to say, faith without works is dead, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. Everyone circle that. I want to know what it does not say. It does not say that I'm going to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for me. Right? It does not say through going to a lot of meetings. It does not say through therapy. And don't get me wrong, I love therapy. Okay? I love therapy. I've been to more therapy than most people will ever go to in their lifetime. Right? And I'm here to tell you, therapy's great, but therapy doesn't work for a guy like me. You know? And you know why? Because all it does is give me an hour to talk about my favorite subject. Me. Right? Me. Right? And what this book tells me is that's exactly what I don't need to do. I need to think about someone other than me. Okay? Because here's one of the great truths if you're new about Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? Is when I'm thinking about you, I'm too dumb to think about me. Right? I'm too dumb to think about me. And that's how this program works. Right? And see, I just go to therapy, and what it doesn't say is I'm supposed to switch drunken self-centeredness for sober self-centeredness. Right? And there's a lot of people that do that. Right? I've done that myself. Right? I've learned the hard way. Right? And I'm here to tell you, you can be just as miserable sober sometimes if you don't work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as you can drunk. That's what they call a dry drunk. Right? And anybody who's been sober for any length of time can tell you that that does happen. It's happened to me. When I was 10 years sober, I was as close to drinking as I think that I've ever been. Right? And I was working with 50 guys, and I was doing this, and I was doing that, and I was doing the other. My sponsor said, you're living like a damn atheist. You know? I was offended. You know? I was offended. I hung up the phone on the guy. I'm like, does this guy know who I'm freaking California Rob. You know what I'm saying? This guy's talking to me like that. You know what I'm saying? But you know what? He was exactly right. He was exactly right. And I needed to realize that either you believe in God or you are God, right? And although I believe God existed, I was acting like I was God, right? I had taken back control over my own life, right? And I needed to get back in line. And the beautiful thing is, and we're going to talk about it in the second hour, is the solution in Alcoholics Anonymous is always the same. It's always the same, and it speaks to my spiritual situation no matter where I am. No matter how far down the road I am, it always speaks to my spiritual situation. All right. Next line says, if he did not perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. I think that he just gave us a promise, didn't he? He promised us trials and low spots, didn't he? Right? The certain trials and low spots. So you can mark it down if you're new. You will have trials. You will have low spots. Right? It says, if he did not work, he would surely drink again. That sounds like a promise, doesn't it? Right? If I don't work with others, I will surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. All right. Let's jump over to page 17. We're going to jump into the first part of There Is a Solution here. You know, it's not by any coincidence that right after describing Bill's spiritual experience that he had in Towns Hospital, they give us a title, a chapter entitled There Is a Solution. I want to point out that it does not say there is one solution. This is part of a solution, okay? That this is one of the many solutions in Alcoholics Anonymous. No, there is a solution. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like I tell the guys that I sponsor, I got 12 silver bullets. If that doesn't work for you, I got nothing else for you. You know what I mean? This is it. This is all I got right here. Okay? If this doesn't work, I'm really sorry, but I can't help you. You're going to have to go somewhere else. And it starts out by talking about what kind of people come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. What we found out last week is that we know what our problem is, but we found out in Bill's story, just knowing what the problem is, just knowing that we're powerless, like Bill did, is not enough to keep us sober. So we're going to start right here on page 17, writing a prescription for a solution. And it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. There's that word again, right? Fifth time we found it so far. Have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Not are solving the drink problem. They have solved the drink problem, right? And now he jumps off into who comes to AA. He's talking about the fellowship of AA. He says, we are average Americans, all sections of this country, and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. Everybody underline that. Very important. And that really is true, you know? We are people who normally, when I think about all the people that I have known in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I mean, we are people that just would not mix. I mean, I've been sponsored by guys that I would, none of us should have ever met each other, right? And there's lots of things that bring groups of people together. You know, sometimes you work at the same place, right? That brings people together. Or sometimes maybe you belong to the same church. Or sometimes maybe you have a common interest, right? But what he's saying here is we don't have any of the normal things together, right, that would bring normal groups of people together, right? None of us should have ever met each other. He goes on to say, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful, right? And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. I certainly wouldn't disagree with that, right? There is something powerful about being around a group of people that suffer from the same problem you have, isn't there, right? There's something therapeutic about being around people who have solved the same problem that you're trying to solve, right? And feeling like you're not alone, right? I remember the first couple of meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous I came to, and it's like I felt like for the first time I wasn't a nut, right? That there were people that actually understood how I felt, you know? And I had never felt that way, and I'd known a lot of people, you know? It says, we are like the passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Everybody underline that. Bill's making a reference here. He's drawing an allegory of a ship. Okay? Not just a ship, but a ship that has crashed. And it's interesting what happens in a moment of disaster, right? And on a ship, in the old days, if you wanted to go somewhere, when this book was written, you didn't go by plane, you went by boat. Okay? And on a boat in the old days, there were many different ways to travel. And Bill kind of mentions it here. If you didn't have any money and you needed to get somewhere, you would travel in what was called the steerage section of the boat, which was down in the bottom of the boat below the waterline, right? And it was hot down there, and there was rats down there, right? And it was noisy down there because that's where the engines were. But if you didn't have any money and you needed to travel, that's how you'd go, right? And as you would go up deck by deck by deck, right, you'd get to a little bit better social class, a little bit better economic class, people who had a better education, until you got to the very top deck, right? And on the top deck, there were all these beautiful staterooms, right, with all this fine china and crystal, right? And on that deck, there was a big dining room. And in the dining room, there was a big table. And every night, the captain would come, and he would sit at the captain's table, right? And if you belonged to just the right social class and just the right economic class and had just the right background, you might get invited to sit at the captain's table, right? You with me so far? Okay. Now, why am I telling you this? Here's why. Because the guy who's sitting on his bunk eating a peanut butter sandwich in the steerage section and the guy who's sitting at the captain's table having a dinner, a lobster dinner, they should never have met, should they? Right? They have nothing in common, just like we don't have anything in common, right? But in the moment of disaster, something incredible happens, doesn't it? I was just watching the show last week about that plane that landed in the Hudson River in New York, right? And all those people jumped off the plane, right? They never met each other before, right? But when they got in that cold water in the Hudson River, I wasn't there, but I'm going to make a guess. I highly doubt that they talked about who had the most money, who had the better house, who went to the right church, who had the better education. The only thing they were probably interested in at that time was saving themselves and saving one another, right? And I'll tell you, I watched some of the interviews that they did, and you know, the camaraderie that these people had after going through that incident. I remember after Hurricane Charlie, you know, I met neighbors that I had never met before, right? They were coming over to help me out, and I was going to help them out. And I remember thinking to myself, gosh, it's so sad that it has to take something like this for me to meet my neighbors who've lived across the street from me for 6 years. You know what I mean? But that's what it took. And Bill's saying that, you know what, we're like those passengers of a great liner right after shipwreck, right? And there's a joyousness and a camaraderie that exists in Alcoholics Anonymous that most people would not understand, right? It goes on to say, though, unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy of escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. See, they had that moment on that plane, and they were all rescued, and they had that moment of joyousness and camaraderie. Bill says what separates us, though, is our joy doesn't escape as we go our individual ways. See, and I'll tell you, that's been true for me no matter where I have gone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have found the same thing. I found fast friends. I found people who cared about me, who were interested in what I was doing, who were talking about the same things and dealing with the same struggles and challenges that I was dealing with, right? It says, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. Now, let's remember that this entire paragraph is about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And at the top of the paragraph, Bill says, being a part of this fellowship is indescribably wonderful, doesn't he? Right? But here at the bottom of the paragraph, he gives us a warning, doesn't he? He says that the fellowship alone, the fact that we share, have a common problem, that in itself is not enough, right? That's not enough to hold us together as we are now joined, right? Now, they don't have a problem with that when they didn't have a problem with that when they wrote this. They had a small fellowship, right? They had about 100 men and women scattered across the countryside, right? They didn't have many meetings. In 1939, when the book was published, they had 3 meetings in the world. We talked about that 2 weeks ago, right? There was a meeting in Cleveland, a meeting in Akron, and a meeting in New York. That was it, right? But I think what's happened is our fellowship has gotten so big that some people have tried to stay sober on just that one element of this powerful cement which binds us, right? Just the element of the fellowship itself, right? And Bill says right here that that in itself is not enough to hold us together. And I don't know where we've got that idea, because the book warns us right here that that in itself is not enough, doesn't he? Right? Let me ask you a question. Will the wrong action bring about the right result? Will the wrong action bring about the right result? Anyone? No? Will more of the wrong action bring about the right result? Okay, then let me ask you a question. When we get a newcomer who goes out and drinks, and he comes back and we tell him, just go to more meetings, right? Do more of what didn't work the first time, right? Isn't that what we tell him, right? You know, I'm going to read something out of the 12 by 12 here, if I can keep all this stuff from falling off here. This is from page 39, and you don't have to turn there if you don't have it. I'll just read it. But this kind of brings this point home for me. It says, of course, the sponsor points out that our friend's life is still unmanageable even though he's sober, that after all, only a bare start on AA's program has been made. More sobriety brought about by the admission of alcoholism, step one, and by the attendance of a few meetings is good indeed, but it is bound to be a far cry from permanent sobriety and a contented and useful life. That's where the remaining steps of the AA program come in. Nothing short of continuous action upon these as a way of life can bring about the much desired result. And what's the much desired result? He just told me. Permanent sobriety and a contented and useful life, right? And what Bill just repeated in the 12 by 12 that he said in the big book 12 years earlier is that meetings of the fellowship alone are insufficient to keep me permanently sober. Okay? So, now that he's told us what will not keep me sober, right? Now he's going to tell me what really does bind us together, or what the real cement is that holds us together in Alcoholics Anonymous. It goes on to say in the next paragraph, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Everybody circle that. We're coming back to it. And that's the real cement right there. Not the common problem, not the fellowship, the common solution, right? And incidentally, we're going to talk about this when we get to page 25. a common solution produces a common effect. Everybody write that down. In other words, another way of saying that is if we all have, we all have the flu, and they determine that the cure for the flu is penicillin, and we all go take penicillin, we're all going to get the same result. Does that make sense, everybody? We're all going to get well, okay? The common solution that they're talking about here is going to produce a common effect, okay? If I apply the common solution that they applied, I can expect to get the same result that they got, okay? And they're going to tell us what that result is when we get to page 25. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree, right? So the first 80 members that wrote this book all agreed that this was the solution right here, right? This is it. And that's important, okay? Because again, remember, if I'm disagreeing with what he put here, what Bill put here, I'm not just disagreeing with Bill, I'm disagreeing with what the first 80 members, the founders, the pioneers of our program believed, okay? Even the ones that didn't make it believed that this was the solution, right? And we have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. Okay, so a newcomer comes to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? And what are they supposed to see? They're supposed to see all of us joined in brotherly and harmonious action upon the common solution, right? Is that what they see? I don't know. Use your own experience, okay? I think sometimes that's what they see, right? That's what attracted me to Alcoholics Anonymous is I saw people, not everyone, but I saw people that had something I wanted, right? That had that look on their face, that had that peace in their voice, that had that look in their eyes. They had that same look that Ebby had when he came to Bill's door, right? That look that something was different, that they weren't living like, they weren't feeling the way I felt, right? And that's what they're supposed to see when they walk in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if they're not, okay, then shame on us, okay? Shame on us, because that's the whole purpose of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be a living example of the power of the common solution. Does that make sense, everybody? A living example of the power of the common solution. That's what the fellowship is. And thank God it is, right? Thank God it is, right? Now let's reread that sentence one more time and we'll finish it here. It says, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism, right? Not the news of the fellowship, the news of the common solution. That's the great news that this book carries, right? Now, the whole idea here, for those of you who are new, is that between the power of the fellowship, which is one element, and the power of the common solution, which is the real cement, that between those two things combined, it will overcome my individual problem and I will be able to recover from alcoholism, okay? But if you're new, let me tell you this, you gotta have both things. You can't just have one, okay? If you hear anything in this workshop, hear that. You gotta have both things. You gotta have the fellowship and you have to have the power of the common solution. Now, you'd think that they would tell us right here what the common solution is, wouldn't you? Right? But they don't, okay? See, this is the first book Bill ever wrote. Okay, so he's not going to tell us for another 8 pages what the common solution is. Okay, but a good book will always explain itself. And so Bill is going to spend the next 8 pages telling us what won't work, what the common solution is not, and why we have to have this common solution that he's going to tell us about on page 25. Okay, and as a matter of fact, he's going to tell us 4 times on page 24 what will not work, and why the fellowship alone is insufficient to keep a guy like me sober, right? And we'll get there in a few minutes. All right, let's turn to page, where are we going here? Page 18. We'll take a break in about 5 minutes. Actually, we're going to page 19. Top of the page. None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we feel its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Everybody circle that. Not an ending. It's a beginning. A much more important of our demonstration, a much more important demonstration of our principles, these 12 steps, lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. And you could write right there, my life. That's what your home, your occupation, and your affairs is. That's called your life. Okay? So even more important than my demonstration of staying sober is what I do in my life. Okay? Because guess what? Nobody in my life cares if I'm sober, if I'm still an asshole. Right? And I'm telling you, and I say this sometimes, and people laugh, but I'm not only a recovering alcoholic, I'm a recovering asshole. Okay? And there have been times, and if you don't believe me, ask my wife, okay, where I can be a real asshole, you know? And so this is, for me, is not just about not drinking. It's about overcoming those defects of character that make me alcoholic, okay, that continue to harm people. You know, you can always see an alcoholic, not by the alcohol on their breath. He's the one or she's the one that everyone else stays away from, right? Yeah, right? You know what I'm talking about, right? All right. Let's go to page 20. Page 20, top of the page, our very lives. Gee, I wonder how important that is. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant, not occasional, thought of others, not myself, and how we may help meet their needs. Now, you know, that's not very popular with alcoholics, you know? That is just not very popular. And the reason it's not very popular is it goes against my nature, right? My nature is mentioned on page 61 and 62. I am selfish and self-centered, right? That is my nature, right? And I can't see how helping someone else, thinking about you, is going to do anything for me. And it's because it's a lot more comfortable for me to go to my meeting on Monday night, right, and talk about my favorite subject. Right? Me. Right? And my car payment. And my house. And my kids. Right? Anybody ever been there? Yeah? You know what I'm talking about? I got an idea. How about instead of doing that, I had this great idea a couple of years ago. I had a sponsor who goes around. He does a lot of workshops and things like that. A great guy from Las Vegas. And one of the things that I asked him to sponsor me, he says, I got an idea. He says, and at the time, I was going through a difficult time. I mean, my wife was pissed off at me. My kids were pissed off at me. My boss was pissed off at me. And I'm thinking, God, what is wrong with all these people, you know? And he said, hey, I got a great idea. He said, why don't you spend 1 hour a week thinking of someone other than yourself? You know? And I didn't get it. I didn't get what he was saying at all, you know? I thought, well, that's a novel idea. Maybe I could work that into my busy schedule, you know? But this is not, and what I found, though, is when I begin to do that, I move myself out of the center of my own life, right? And really, that's what self-centeredness is. It's me being the center of my own life. And when I'm in the center of my own life, I can't see it. See? That's the problem. The problem for a guy like me, and if you're like me, you're like this, is that I can't see it when I'm self-centered, right? I don't feel like I'm sick when I'm sick. But you know what? You all look sick, right? That's the problem. And I feel like I have an obligation to straighten you out. You know, it's really kind of service. You know what I mean? I have to point out to you where you're screwed up, you know? And so that is why I need to think of other people, right? Because somehow when I get out of self, I get well. And I had this great idea. And the great idea was, hey, instead of worrying about my problems and my marriage and my kids and my job, why don't I focus on helping that other person? Because if I believe what the book says on page 45, it's going to tell me lack of power is my delight. I don't have the power to solve my problems anyway. Right? When I took the third step, I entered into a contractual agreement with God. My part of the contract is I got to do His work, perform His work well, and stick close to Him. And His part of the deal is He's going to provide everything that I need. Right? And if I really believe that, then it changes the way I act. Right?